Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. Of course, that's the great Sarah Vaughan, passed away on this day, 1990. Can't give you anything but love. One of the great songs of all time. I'm reminding you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to Common Core, you can learn about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website, at MarylandEducators.org. That's one word, MarylandEducators.org. Or you can go to SteinerShow.org and click on the Maryland State Education Association's banner there on our website. We now switch gears here on the Mark Steiner Show and talk about another incredible new film, which I thought the way it was shot, the way the story it told was nuanced, where it talked about a piece of history we didn't know about, talked about culture the way we didn't know about it, demonized no one, and kind of looked at what this world means. It's called Soul Food Junkie. And we're joined by Byron Hurt, who is the filmmaker. He's an award-winning documentary filmmaker, published writer, anti-sexist activist, and lecturer. The film Soul Food Junkies was critically acclaimed, won CNN Best Documentary Award at the Maryland Black Film Festival, and Best Documentary at the Urban World Film Festival in New York City. And the film Soul Food Junkies made its national television premiere on PBS, Emmy Award-winning series Independent Lens, last January. In studio is Denzel Mitchell, founder of Five Seeds Family Farm and Apiary in Baltimore, and one of the panelists at this weekend's event looking at Soul Food Junkie. And his friend knows how to cook some soul food. I can attest to that. And fresh food. And Naja White is with us.
Right.
And always good to see her. She's a restaurateur of the Land of Kush, which is a vegetarian soul food restaurant, a restaurant in Baltimore, one of the panelists also at this week's event. And I'll say, eating at that restaurant, you taste the ribs that they make. I brought many meat eaters there, and they said, "What? This is not meat." But no. So good to have the three of you with us.
Good morning. Yeah,
good morning.
Absolutely. Good morning.
Good morning. And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages or tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. Byron, let me start with you, the filmmaker. Amazing film. I just loved it. And one of the things that was clear the way you started the film was this film was motivated in many senses for you, I think, by love. Love of your father, love of the family, but love of black people and the culture and wrestling with where it all comes from.
That is correct. And I really appreciate you acknowledging that and recognizing that. The film completely came from a place of love, and it was inspired by my father. But my intention was to create a film that was going to purposefully reach a large audience of color, you know, who could begin to really start thinking critically about our consumption habits, our relationship to food, our access to food, many of the nutritional related illnesses that we have that are connected to the food that we eat. And so it was really designed to create, or I would say add to, a national conversation about food and health and wellness and food security and all of those other issues.
And all those issues were raised here. And this is what I think. And have you both seen the film?
No, I'm waiting till Sunday. I want to be
You're
excited
waiting till
and
Sunday.
Moving. Oh, yeah.
If I had known, I snuck and shared the film with Denzel. You've seen the film, right?
Okay, yeah.
But everybody should see this film. It's not to miss this. I just really believe this can be a great discussion as well. But let me just raise some issues that I thought came out of the film for me. And I think that it's one of the things you just were talking about a moment ago, Byron, that it's such a complex piece. Mm-hmm. Because part of what's coming to America right now, in some ways, I think, changing in the last 40 years, but really kind of changing in ways that are more rapid than I think we realized in the last 10, 15 years,
I agree,
is the power of black culture in this country and how it's transforming consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And being transformed internally but externally as well throughout the whole society, you know.
Yes.
And food is part of it,
yes,
right?
Yep.
I mean, what would be, there are other cultures have it as well, but what could be a more American cuisine than soul food?
Right, right, right. And the other thing is that, you know, American cuisine itself is heavily influenced all over this country's landscape by the foodways of African Americans, and there's been more than enough study to document that. You know, no matter where you are, you know, people are eating what they're eating today, white folks, whoever, wherever they are, based on how people were cooking for them 200 years ago, 300 years ago, and how and how food has just moved through the culture, and you know, and that color context kind of gets pulled away, you know. But we're sitting down eating at these nice restaurants, and people forget that this is how black folks were preparing their food, and now it is an American way, as American as apple pie, as American as sweet potato pie, right? You know, so that's really important. That's another part of the conversation that's kind of marginalized.
Because I mean, all the food we eat, the flavor of food in many parts of our food came from the black world. They got married with the Indian world. They brought pieces that didn't exist before, corn or potatoes and peanuts,
hot peppers. Hot peppers, right.
That was the native people who brought that stuff to our plate. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
But with that, Mark, I think there comes an overindulgence of that. So people are eating socially, but they're also eating to, you know, hide some things or comfort themselves in certain ways, whether it's depression, mental illness and things like that. So now we have negative effects, whether it's obesity, and you can see it in the kids, heart disease, stroke, cancer. So the land of Kush understands the whole soul food concept, and that's why we brought to the market a healthier way.
A vegan soul food.
A healthier way to eat. So you can still enjoy that, because you said yourself you brought some meat-eating friends. So you have a place you can come, and you can be vegan, vegetarian, omnivore, herbivore, and you can still enjoy food that tastes good.
And I bring them there. I must admit, I am an omnivore, so I have to put that up front. Put that up front there. Byron, I mean, one of the things I think that was just said here is really a part of the theme of the film, too, is that food was about comfort and survival.
Mm. Yes. Mm-hmm.
And you raise that in the film in terms of what the roots of soul food are, and also, well, let me just stop there, let you go.
Well, I agree with both of the panelists on this call that, you know, food has, you know, it has really served us in many different ways historically. And, you know, in a lot of ways, the current relationship that we have with food connects us back to the past in so many different ways, and it brings back really great memories of family and holidays and you know, moments where we come together collectively as family units, as a people, et cetera, et cetera. The one thing that I really wanted to make sure that I did not do was to completely demonize soul food, because there are so many soul food dishes that are within the tradition that are healthy, that are good for you, and if cooked and prepared properly, they provide many benefits, nutrient benefits. So you know, I definitely wanted to make it very clear that this was not about throwing soul food under the bus. It was about sort of redefining our relationship to soul food so that we can eat healthier, so that we can eat cleaner, and that we could sort of go back to, you know, the history of black agriculturalists who, you know, who worked the land and who prepared their own food, and the food was organic and it was fresh and it was not processed. And, you know, to get people to sort of think about that in ways that is transformative for them, you know, so that people can say, you know what, you know, there's another way of serving my body, serving myself, other than going to a fast food restaurant or cooking, you know, some of the soul food dishes that are not the healthiest for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that was a really important piece in the film where you talked about that the soul food that we see today in, you know, in our current diet is very different than the soul food that grandma or grandmama or big mama would have prepared, because the food was nutrient rich, nutrient dense, because it was coming from the garden, or, you know, and there was this relationship with black agricultural practices that brought the food in. And so, but then when the food industry changes in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, then the food that's coming into the house also changes. So there's that difference as well. You know, I'm sure we've all sat down to the table and somebody tried to slide us some fake mashed potatoes.
Right? I can't stand it.
You know, you can't stand it.
I can't stand it.
You know, so we have to, you know, so it gets to be an extremely complicated conversation because we've been so, you know, our culture, what this connection we have to food has been so tainted by all the other things that are happening around us, which dictates how the food was created in the first place, right? So it's just really interesting. I have to go back, though. I got to say thank you to Byron for doing yet another personally paradigm-shifting film for me because, you know, your first film, I didn't think I'd ever get a chance to say this to you, but I had just moved to D.C., and I got to see your first film, Hip Hop Beyond Beats and Rhymes, and it was paradigm-shifting, so I appreciate that, and I appreciate this film, too. And, you know, you were talking about not demonizing the food. We cannot do that because I posted right. Some on Facebook, and my mother, you know, she's probably going to get to listen to this at some point. She said, you better not. Because your grandmother fed you like royalty, which is true, you know. And for them, this was a opportunity for them to communicate to their families that we made it, right?
So we have to take a very quick break. We're going to come back. Najee, I know you want to say something. We'll let you come right back and say it. We can listen to a couple of clips from the film. I want to explore also the issue that one of the people in the film raised about the nature of slavery and food and how it's more complex than we want to paint it in a popular picture. 410-319-8888 is the number here. We take a break. Going out here with Lullaby of Birdland by the great Sarah Vaughan. She passed away on this day in 1990. Stay with us.
In a phrase, how I feel. Have you ever heard two turtle doves, Bill and Coo, when they love? That's the kind of man.
Make things healthy. I like healthy living today.
No fried chicken?
Well,
no fried chicken.
Hard giving up that fried chicken.
I feel you. It was hard for me to cut back on fried chicken too. Until I learned about the health risks associated with some of my favorite comfort foods.
When you fry foods, you can sometimes increase the levels of carcinogens, the things that can cause cancer. A lot of times, the way the food is given to you, it's like large amounts, especially of the starches. So if you get a lot of sweet potatoes and yams or sweets, all those carbohydrates in too high amounts can be a problem for you.
I don't remember things being so heavily full of oil and sugar like they've become now. So I think that's where the soul food story gets a little sad. We had meals together that were fresh and that weren't packaged most of the time. So I think one of the things that has happened is that we have started going outside of ourselves and outside of the community to get quick, fast, cheap food.
The most important thing is that people complicate their understanding of what soul food is, because it's easy to say that it's the bane of African-American health. The bigger cause of the decline of African-American health is the industrialization of our food system 4 or 5 decades ago. The goal of these corporations that are producing food is to make it cheap.
And that's a clip from the film that featured Brian Terry and Michaela Angela Davis. Incredible people he had to interview in this movie. So we're talking about Soul Food Junkie. Byron Hirth, filmmaker, is with us, along with Denzel Mitchell and Najee Wright, who will be on the panel this Sunday with him at the Lewis Museum, Reginald E. Lewis Museum in downtown Baltimore, Sunday, April 16th at 2 p.m. You can go to rflewismuseum.org for more information. It'll be on our website as well. Just go and show up. It's an incredible film, and they're here with us to talk about it. But this particular clip, Byron, I thought was really important because, to me, this is a little short piece. It's like the complexity of the issue that you're raising, and also the fact that you had, we'll get back to the other part in a minute, about these incredible, deep thinkers you had on this film. It just blew me away. But but talk a bit about this, the complexity you're trying to get to with this.
Well, first, I just want to thank Denzel for the compliments that he paid me right before the break. I really appreciate that, and it means a lot to me to have people sort of give me that kind of positive feedback about the films that I make. So thank you for that.
Oh, yeah.
I always try to make, you know, in the work that I do, I always try and complicate the subject matter because, you know, I don't really see the world in terms of black and white. There's a lot of gray area, you know, in the world, and you know, I try to locate and find people who will be able to flesh out ideas and the subjects, the topics that I'm covering, so that you know, people can have you know, a nuanced understanding of that topic. You know, so it was really important for me to really track down and find people who I could talk to who really knew the subject very well. You know, people who were connected to soul food, people who had done research and written books about soul food and other aspects of the Black culinary tradition that I thought would be really, you know, engaging and compelling and smart, and also entertaining characters to be in the film. So that's important to me, you know, to give depth and breadth, but to also entertain as well.
So what about part of this argument? I mean, we can just enter into it. I think it's a really interesting part of the discussion. I mean, what ended this clip was the industrialization of our food system in the 40s changed the entire nature of the way people eat food in America.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that it also changed the nature of soul food, because Black folks leaving the country weren't growing fresh vegetables in their gardens, weren't getting them from their neighbors.
Right.
And that changed the nature of our food.
Well, one word I heard in there was cheap. Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's cheaper. Another thing that you see is people need food fast. So we're going into this whole fast food, fast casual, and mm-hmm. actually the fast casual restaurant businesses are growing and increasing. You know, everyone wants mm-hmm. everything fast, quick. So, you know, you have more processed food. You know, they just want it now. So what we had to do at the Land of Kush, in order to bring the vegan concept out there, we had to make sure we made food that people can be familiar with. So collard greens.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to use pork or turkey or any of that to season your collard greens. You can use natural herbs and spices and things like that, and the collard greens still taste good.
You use smoke seasoning?
You can use smoke seasoning. Yes, there's smoke seasoning. There's smoked tofu, but we don't use the smoked tofu anymore because of soy allergies. Your baked mac and cheese. We make our own vegan cheese. So that's the whole creative process right there. You know, making our own cheeses, which is less fat, no cholesterol. But the thing still is cheap and fast. You still got to think, you know, we have a large population and people don't want to spend a lot of money. So how do you, you know, overcome that?
Wait a minute. Where is your restaurant located?
The Land of Kush is located at 840 North Utah Street, right off of Martin Luther King. Landofkush.com is the website. 410-225-KUSH. 410-225-5874.
I may have to stop by.
Yeah, by today. I want to see you today.
When you come to Baltimore, you have to do it. It's Land of Kush is amazing. My wife always says, can you please stop there on the way home? Why don't you stop there? Why don't you stop there on the way home? So I do.
And we have a diverse customer base. I mean,
you do.
Yeah, very, you do. Very diverse. We're talking about all socioeconomic backgrounds, you know, all colors and flavor. Just everyone comes in there. So we didn't expect that, but that's a good thing.
So it reminds me of the restaurant that was in the film in Newark that you talked about. And I think that, I mean, that there's a piece of this film that I really want to explore a bit. And it came early in the film before we play this next clip, some people were talking about slavery and the roots of food and soul food and so one of the things that people, somebody said, that one of the women said in that movie is no slave could have survived mm-hmm. on this diet if it was just the throwaways, if it was just
right.
the leftovers, if it was just what's in the trough that people had. The slaves must have eaten something else besides that, or they couldn't have had the caloric intake to do the slave work
exactly.
that was required of them.
That
right?
was incredible. Right? We're talking about that. It couldn't have been just one peck of corn and three smoked fish.
That's right.
Right. And this is something we understand, because historians have been telling us that people were controlling their own food system from the time that they
slaves
got here.
Slaves were controlling it. Well, yeah,
enslaved right. Africans. They were bringing seeds from Africa. They
were being in their hair and everywhere else.
Put them in their hair.
Right,
they
right,
were being
right.
brought here to grow food for their enslavers, but they also were growing food for themselves. They had to, because they had to provide for themselves. So not only are they providing for themselves this nutrient-dense food, but then, you know, they talked about feeding they feeding their enslavers' children, and how that affected the trajectory of food. That is an incredibly important conversation to have that we do not have, right? It's almost like people talk about soul food just kind of popping up out of this vacuum,
right,
and not being this trajectory right. of the experience, the African American experience, right? So that was a really interesting piece in the film, and I understand that because that's part of my that's a part of how I was raised, that you know there were matriarchs in my family that had been growing food, and that's all that they knew: growing food, curing their own hams, smoking their own fish, milking their own cows, keeping their own chickens, and that's the food that they prepared for us. And so, you know, so that was soul food for me. And then when I moved to the city and I had soul food, I'm like, wait a minute, this is not the same thing.
I'm glad Denzel mentioned that.
You grew up in that strange place in the South called Oklahoma.
Yeah, I grew up in that strange place in the South called Oklahoma. You know, it's funny because that he talked about that cooking contest in Muskogee. I've been there.
Oh, the soul food?
Yeah, the soul food cooking
contest. I'm going to check that out one day.
We need to go down there. We need to go down there and for a rodeo. Black rodeo.
Denzel mentioned, okay, his exposure to farming, so farm to table. Mm-hmm. And when you come to the city or you transition to the city, right. You don't have that exposure. So think about the younger generations.
Right.
No idea. When I grew up, my mother actually put me into a program where they took inner city children from the city into the country. So my first exposure to rural or let's say suburbia, where you had farms and things like that, was at six. So when I came back to the city, you know, I was nearly crying. Like, it's just different. You see things differently. Your mind is broadened. So we need to bring more of these kids out to or expose them to urban farming and things like that.
We're going to get to a clip about that in just a moment. That's the next clip we're going to play with Will.
See, I'm
Allen.
Hitting it right on the nose.
It's right out of my mind.
Right.
This is good. Byron, let me say this, though. One of the things I do when I ask you this is that any real documentary filmmaker or author, writer, when they begin a project, something changes them when they do the product, when they do the work. And it comes out of it. And I think that, you know, you began this exploration partially because of your love for your dad, who died much too young, right?
Yes.
And his love for food helped kill him, and how hurtful that was to all of you. So talk a bit about this journey you took in this film. I'm curious where you started and where you came to.
Well, you know, I think the film was born out of a certain place of pain, right? Losing my father and wanting to, I guess, impose some of my own ideas and values around food and health and fitness onto my father. And I think throughout the process of making the film, and certainly by the end of the film, I realized that, you know, someone changing their eating habits is deeply, deeply personal. And it's a very difficult thing to do for a lot of people. And I think I have come to appreciate how difficult it is for people to change their habits, to change their palate, to go outside of their comfort zone, to appreciate foods that they may not have grown up with or be accustomed to. So I have a deeper appreciation for that. That's one thing. But I also have a hyper awareness about the food industry and sort of like the underbelly or the ills of the food industry that creates so much highly processed food that is really not healthy for you. And in a lot of ways, it's marketed as good for you and healthy for you. But when you turn around, you turn the box around, you look at the ingredients, you realize that they're not very healthy for you at all. So, I mean, I'm just very hyper aware of the food industry and what I put into my own body. It's kind of made me sheepish, you know, about eating, you know, about eating outside of my own home.
I understand that completely.
Well, how do you describe the mentality that some of us may have where I'm going to die anyway? So 65 or 65, right. 70, that's cool. I've lived my life.
Something's going to kill me, right?
Exactly.
I just look at it. It's very self-defeating. You know, I think it's not taking a long view of your life. And it's a choice. It's a personal choice that people make. But, you know, I think people don't really take into consideration the quality of the kind of life that they're going to be living at that age, right?
Exactly.
Right. Whether they go, you know, early or later on in life, you know, into their 90s. I think people don't really make that connection between the food that they're eating today and the impact that it may have on their lives, you know, when they get into their 70s and their 80s and maybe their 90s.
Right. But, you know, the thing is, like, these decisions are being made, you know, out of insecurity, or, you know, we could even, you know, talk about not knowing or ignorance, because, you know, we're perpetuating our death. And so, you know, we kind of have this laissez-faire attitude. We're like, oh, well, I'm not going to make it anyway, so I'm just keep going to Popeye, or, you know,
right.
Or, YOLO, you know, you only live once, so, yeah. You know, might as well enjoy it.
Well, can I say this really quickly? I don't want to detract the conversation.
Go ahead.
But, you know, I travel all over the country, as many of you probably do as well. And, you know, I've been showing this film all over the country in addition to my previous film, Beyond Beats and Rhymes. And, you know, it's very, very easy to recognize when I'm in a community of color, particularly a poor community of color, because you see the limited access that people have to quality food in the supermarkets around them, you know, the abundance of fast food restaurants, and to me it's just very it's sad, and it's hurtful, and it's enraging, you know, that people are being limited to the kind of food that they have access to. You know, and you know, you asked me earlier about how I came out of this project.
Mm-hmm.
I came out of this project, you know, with a sense of, you know, greater awareness of how important food is to the vitality of an individual and a community.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. When your community is suffering from malnutrition, even though they may be obese, but they're still malnourished,
right.
It has a tremendous impact on that entire community.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I'm sure that, you know, everyone else can kind of speak to that. But, you know, you travel around the country and you hit Martin Luther King Boulevard or Malcolm X Boulevard or whatever the name of the street is, you are sure to have a decrease in the kind of options that you have at your disposal where you can eat something healthy.
Right. Yeah, I agree with that 100%. When you're talking about food, actually, the type of food you consume can have an impact on your ability to think clearly. So eating liver foods, you know, may be better for you. Going vegan, vegetarian.
I keep talking about that. I haven't got there yet, but let me go to the phones here. Before we go to the phone's calling, let me just play this clip. I'm going to get this Will Allen clip in because it feeds right into what we were just talking about. This is Will Allen from the film.
In here, as we grow sprouts, we grow about 2,000 trays a week. They go to the Milwaukee Public Schools.
I come from a legacy of growing food for people. That's how this whole thing started, by me purchasing this facility to grow food and sell it to the folks in this community. But also it has to be combined with education, because once people get into that mold of eating bad food, their first taste of really good food tastes strange to them.
Run my own farmer's market now at 61st Street Market. You come there and get y'all fresh produce if y'all in Chicago.
I see more African-American people getting involved. The kids are passing on the word to their parents and other adults in the community. To me, this is a multicultural, multi-generational revolution. You see the examples of community gardens in those communities popping up.
The Lower Ninth Ward isn't all about devastation and, oh, it's so horrible what happened after Katrina. But, you know, we're actually taking the initiative and taking responsibility for making sure that we have a brighter future, you know, making sure that we have food security.
Now, this to me was a really important concept, because people live in food deserts and these corner stores and all this stuff is happening. People are denied access to food in many ways by the nature of the system and by the nature of the marketplace and the capitalist marketplace and what it does. But, like, let's take Baltimore for a moment, since we're here, and you'll be coming here soon, Byron, with your film. Matter of fact, this Sunday at 2 p.m. at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum. Don't want to miss it. With all these people on this program and be on that panel. But We have lots of vacant lots here. Baltimore could almost feed itself. People could feed themselves in the communities. I was driving down North Avenue the other day, coming in from D.C., and I was driving and past these three really brightly colored houses right on North Avenue, just around Pennsylvania Avenue. And right next to it, there's these two houses that only had the walls up, and then there was the lots were empty, right, mm-hmm. next to the houses. And I can see Baltimore say, oh, we have to tear the whole block down and move people out. But supposing you took lots like that and you had vertical gardens growing up there with a place in the back for people to sit. Mm-hmm. You had these empty lots and people could grow their, I know, don't get upset with the menage, but you could grow your own chickens, raise chickens if you want to, and for eggs or whatever else, yeah, and have absolutely. Your own vegetables, because you're allowed to have chickens in Baltimore.
Yeah.
You know, people don't know that. I mean, but that's what in some ways the movement has to begin.
Mm-hmm.
If you wait for them to change the system to bring food to people, it's not happening.
I agree with you 100%, you know what I'm saying? Mark. I agree with you 100%. So the plan has to be in place to acquire or adopt these lots.
Or
I know
just
they have
take
the style.
Them.
Take them.
Just take them. You know, that's the thing. You know, that's how we met. You just take
right.
it.
Just take it.
You know, there was land across the street from my house, right here in Baltimore City, and I took it.
I mean, if you take it, people grew for their own food, and then you look and say, oh, you're going to take it back from us now?
Right. Y'all weren't doing anything with it anyway.
Right, and we're growing food.
We're growing food on it. We are growing food and giving it to folks, you know, increasing food
letting people
food
grow
access.
Their own food and take it home.
Yeah. I mean, folks want to eat. They want actual, real food. You know, if it's available and they get to taste it, you know.
That's what we can say.
Well, it has to be a community effort, because you don't want to start something, then you have someone in there making damage. So it really needs to be a community effort. The community needs to be involved collectively, and I think it's an awesome plan. When can we get started?
Right now.
Right now. Do it.
But Byron.
Yes.
Because part of what you saw, like in New Orleans, the places where people trying to take control of their own lives and not waiting. Right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I've met several people around the country who are doing just that. In fact, there's a brother in Los Angeles. I just saw a TED Talks that he did, and I cannot think of his name right now, but he did exactly what you just talked about. He just took over vacant lots.
Ron Finley.
Food.
Ron Finley,
right.
Yeah.
And I think he did run into some legal trouble, but I think at the end, he overcame it and prevailed.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there are people who are doing just that. And they are self-defining and creating these sort of independent food systems that are not connected to large supermarket chains or huge corporations.
Mm-hmm.
And they're providing a service for the people in that community who otherwise could not go to a Whole Foods and spend their entire check, you know, for
right.
vegetables.
Whole paycheck. Yeah, so whole paycheck, we call it.
Yeah, that's where I shop.
Yeah, whole check.
I like it too, but it's expensive.
Yeah, yeah. I agree.
I'm not expensive. Y'all can come buy vegetables from me.
I love your vegetables.
So, you know, we have to look at, you know, creating new systems of, you know, producing, you know, food for our communities. And I think there are a lot of people who are, you know, more well-versed than I am about it, who are doing a tremendous job on the ground already doing that on a daily basis. And, you know, I give them a lot of props for doing that.
Let me open the phones here, 410-319-8888. And Owusu, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning. This brings back some old memories, because back in the 70s, I actually had a talk show on Morgan's radio station. But I'm an agriculturist. I study agriculture, and I worked at Southern University before I retired in the field of agriculture. And I watched the film, and I really liked it. But
thank
in a
you.
Sense, it's, the title of it is a little misleading, because our contributions to agriculture were not just confined to soul food. A lot of crops originated in Africa, such as your melons, your okra, types of yams, not the sweet potatoes, but the true yams. And I was glad to see the conversation change through the community garden. Somebody said it needs to start. It's already started all over the country. You were talking about Detroit. You talk about Milwaukee, New Orleans, Baton Rouge, where I am. It's a lot of emphasis in terms of doing something to address the shortage of food. Even with fruit, we actually had a gardening project in one of the prisons down in Baton Rouge with the juveniles.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an excellent program. Oh, and one final thing. On the farming side, I actually was a co-founder of there's an organization called the Southeastern African American Farmers Organic Network. So we kind of do things both from the farmer perspective as well as from the community to have a holistic approach to solving this problem of food security.
Augusto, thank you very much. Well, thank you very much. It was really interesting. I want to know more about what you're doing. Let's get another quick call in here before we have to break. Lolita, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, Lolita.
I just wanted to make a comment.
Sure.
During the winter months, I shop at Mill Valley Garden. It's on 28th and Sisson, and they have a whole lot of organic produce. They sell bulk items, and I find it's a good alternative to shopping at Whole Foods. As well as I hear there's another one, a health food store to open up in the Handham community. I don't remember the name of it.
Well, Mom's is opening up there soon, which is an organic market that's opening up.
There are other alternatives in Whole Foods. And if you ask me, there's nothing so healthy about most of the stuff that's in some of the so-called health food stores. They're not really health food stores anymore. They're classified as natural food markets, which means that they can sell alternative sugar products like maltodextrin and other kinds of sugars that I personally do not want in my body. Hmm. Just because it's labeled or we can keep calling them health food stores, they're more better called natural food stores for the most part because they do not always cater to the health of you. Mm-hmm. That's one of the best stores I found with the health concern because the health concern, they specialized in stuff that was gluten-free. They had a gluten-free section. They had a low-sodium section. Well, they had a no-sodium section for those who had high blood pressure. So I find it's another way, a great way to market to people to, cater to certain health disorders so that they know when they come in the store, they can definitely find products that's just for them.
Lolita, thank you so much. I was only cutting in there because we only have like 2 minutes left here in the segment. Thank you so much. And Judy, you can have like 30 seconds and we got to roll. Judy, we have like 30 seconds. You there? All right. So clear from all the people calling in here, we can't get to everybody. Liam is calling in. Judy's calling in. Everybody's calling back. Mm-hmm. So I wish we had another hour here. We don't. We have to take a break. Another show's got to come up behind us. Michelle Martin is coming up behind us here. So I want to encourage everyone to come out Sunday, April 6th, 2 p.m., Reginald Lewis Museum. Show up. Byron Hirsch bringing his film, Soul Food Junkies to Baltimore. He'll be here. On the panel with him will be two of our guests today, Denzel Mitchell and Nasia Wright. Did I say your name right, baby?
Nasia Wright.
And we'll be there on the panel. Mm-hmm. And this is clearly something that is hitting the heart of many people in our community about what we can do to take control of our food and what soul food really means in its deepest sense, which this movie tackles. Byron Hirsch, thank you so much for making this film.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate the platform, and thank you to everyone who's listening, and hopefully people will come out and support the event on Sunday.
And good to see you too, Denzel and Nasia.
Thanks
great
for
to
having
have you
us,
both Mark. You're both wonderful people. Good to have you here. This has been a great discussion. I think we have to go over to Land of Kush right after the show and get some food.
Yeah. You're open?
Oh, absolutely. Seven days a week.
Okay. So hold on. We'll go. All right. So thank you all so much for being here. And be there this Sunday at 2 p.m. Over at the Reginald E. Museum downtown Baltimore. Mm-hmm. And you can go to RFLEWISmuseum.org and check it out. Also be on our website. Reminding the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you and money comes back in the end. More information, www.mecu.com, or just go to steinershow.org and click on MeQ, Baltimore Credit Union's banner. It's there. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineer is Andre Milton. Alex Boston is our engineer. Taking us out here right now is the wonderful Sarah Vaughn, who passed away on this day in 1990. You can podcast the show, the information about our guests and their work, by visiting us on the web at steinershow.org. You can also listen to and download all of our podcasts now on iTunes. And for public radio, it'll be EAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.
I'll never know a Sunday in this weekday room. I'm talking to the shadows, 1 o'clock to 4. And Lord, how slow the moments go when all I do is pour black coffee. See?